Blog Talk Radio.
So what have you had going on recently?
You know, my main focus now is my new work. This is kind of the first time in a long time that I've had the year ahead of me to dedicate to my own music. So I am just recently home from the Mannheim Steamroller Tour, which was wonderful. Again, it always is. And almost kind of take January off after that. So, you know, it's a grueling tour with it being every night for 2 months in a different city, performing in a different city every night for 2 months. So after you get home from that, it's kind of time to hibernate a little bit. And so just kind of looking at my year ahead, I've had some performances of my own work, starting to get the momentum going for really being a solo artist for most of the year coming up, which is something that I haven't been able to do for many years. So I'm excited about what's ahead.
Of course, we're talking today about Lifting the World. One of the things that really strikes me is that this is a piece of work that runs so counter to pop culture, I guess. It's a risky piece of work in that respect. Was that in your thinking on the front end of it, that, wow, you know, this is a big ask, I guess, for people in terms of the investments you have to make to appreciate a piece of work like that?
You know what? I totally agree that I think, you know, I think that if you kind of just pop it in the car or something and have it in the background, I think that it, probably fine, but I definitely didn't intend it to be that. It is a demanding piece, and I do expect it is kind of, you're right. I do expect a lot of the listener to actually get it. I honestly, when I was in college and kind of starting, you know, trying to figure out what I was going to do with my music career. And I would write to, you know, think, okay, well, I'm going to write a rock song, or I'm going to, you know, try to write a pop song. I didn't really feel like I had much success with that. I didn't feel like, you know, it felt contrived to me. And so when I started to let that go and just say, don't write in a specific style, don't write any sort of calculated way, a formula. Just put your heart out there and see what happens. And that's how my music developed. It's just, I almost feel like I'm a vehicle for this music to have a life, and it's just kind of channeling through me. I never set out to write a symphony. I never set out to write in like a orchestral or world music style. It's just, this is the music that is in me. So the more I do this, and the more that I feel like, the more I'm creating this body of work in this manner, you know, the more I feel like I am really now finally doing what I was meant to do with my life, because it's not something that's contrived. It is just, it's a flow.
Tell me about the idea for Lifting the World. How far back does it go, and what were the first steps you took in the compositional process?
Actually, this has been a labor of love for a long time. When I released my first album in 2002, which is called Like Setting Myself on Fire, I actually hadn't ever performed that music. I recorded it first, and I wound up winning a big contest, the John Lennon Songwriting Contest. Mm-hmm. With one of the pieces on there, the title track won the John Lennon Songwriting Contest, and I was invited to perform at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that was the first performance, that was my first solo performance of my work. And from there, you know, that was from there I started to do concerts of my own music. And when I realized that I was going to be doing these full-length concerts, I thought, well, one album of material is not enough. So I started listening far back as that as almost like, okay, I need more material here. And I wrote it as about a 5-minute piece. And that was, 12 years ago. And I think that one thing that I'm very proud of with the work is that I did allow it to develop. And I allowed it to, I allowed myself to fully explore these themes and not rush it. So I know that, 12 years is kind of a long time between albums, certainly. And I don't think I'm going to do that again. But there is a positive side to it, too. And that is, I look at this work now, and I'm very proud of it. I don't go back and say, I wish I had done this, or I wish I had done that. Like these themes and the way that I layered it, this is fully developed work. And I think that, going through life for the past decade has helped that music evolve.
Not very many people get the opportunity to spend that kind of time on a piece of work, really.
Well, I'm really very fortunate in my career that I'm only doing music that I want to do. And I think that for a musician, I'm very, very fortunate in that way that I don't have to, I've made it work that I can do only music that I love. So I'm not, at a show or something that I have to play just to get by. I have confidence in what I do. And I know that if I'm proud of my work, and I know that if I like what I'm doing, I know that other people are going to like it too. I'm not a total like out on an island left field kind of guy. Like I like normal things. So if I like my work, I think that chances are other people are going to like it too. So I've always just kind of had that mentality of investing myself fully in my music and letting everything else just kind of fall where it falls.
Tell me this. This is arranged, obviously, in a series of movements, some longer and some shorter, and each movement having its own title. Are you trying to tell some sort of a story with the titles that you chose for the movements, or how did you choose how to name what each musical transition?
I only want to hint at an idea for the listener. Just give a slight direction for these titles and the way that I developed the work. I feel that what I'm really going for here is almost sort of like I've created something that can be your own personal soundtrack. So I tend to the music is spiritual without being religious.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that I want the listener to kind of connect with emotionally and personally, and not necessarily have me say, here's what the music's about, see if you can get that out of it. I really much rather have, enjoy when people tell me what it meant to them. So I've sort of created something that hopefully even ministers to, people that are need healing or just having a bad day. Like I said before, I know that a lot of people, they go to hear a concert or they listen to music just for sheer enjoyment. It's something to do. You go, you listen, you move on. But I really, really created this work to have a more personal connection and for people to really be able to use this in whatever way that they need it.
And you actually, when you're not having to write lyrics, does it make it easier to do that? You're not having to explain through the process of lyricism what a thing is about?
I think as soon as there are lyrics, then you're listening to somebody's story. You're listening to a story being told to you, which is fine, but it's not what I want to do. So I don't know if you heard this, but you can hear that there's a choir on,
mm-hmm.
on the album.
Yeah.
And the choir is actually singing in Hindi, and so that is, I'm not expecting the listener to pick up on that. I'm using the choir and I'm using voices as an instrument so that the story comes from from the listener, and the story is not coming from lyrics that you're like, okay, well, that's what this song is about.
Uh-huh. But if somebody had an English to Hindi thesaurus or something, you could maybe glean a little bit of a storyline.
Yeah, it is. You know, it's based on Hindi chanting, like kirtan chanting. So it's based on that. And that was actually, something that I've really been drawn to. It's a beautiful language, and the way that this type of music called kirtan, the way that it is performed, is like a call and response, where the singer will chant, and then the listener will chant that back. And right around the time that I was creating my first album, I was really drawn to that type of music. And then, when I created my own work, it's not that call and response, but I'm taking elements from that based on the language. I'm taking elements from that and incorporating it. Actually, one of my strengths is that I feel like I'm really drawing from a number of different genres with the world music, having a background in rock music, having a formal education in orchestral music. So it's kind of the blend of those things that makes what I do unique. So I don't know if anybody, I really can't, when somebody says, well, who do you sound like? Or, I sound like me. I mean, I don't really hear people doing music like this. So it's not to say that there isn't this out there or that you can't put it in any genre, but I feel like it's very unique in that way.
It really is. It's a little bit of an amalgam of world music and orchestral elements, but in a pretty different way. And I have to confess, I kind of expected like a rock symphony, but it's not that. It's really a straight up symphony, and that's a pretty bold choice. And I think one of the interesting things about this, I think it's probably pretty difficult to compose percussion that has enough of a structure to it that it actually holds together as a song. And you've done that here, and in a couple of instances, where percussion itself is recognizable as a song structure.
Well, thank you for noticing that, and I feel again that there are so many ways that I hope that the listener can peel this back and not skip over things and go, that's just a drum song,
right.
This is okay, here's a slow one, I'm going to skip it, or this sounds like it should be background to something. It's so intricate and it's complex and richly layered that I really am trying to connect with the audience in a way that it's like you can listen to it a number of times and get something different out of it every time you hear it.
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of layered elements to it. And I wanted to ask you this: did you actually compose the symphony in the order in which the different aspects of it appear? Did you compose them at different times and play with different running orders for the different movements? Or how did that all come together? That seems like a pretty big job.
It did piece together. The two, Lifting the World Part 1 and 2, and Three Stories were the three main sections of that piece that actually, when I perform it live and I don't have 55 minutes to dedicate to just that one piece, I will actually take either Lifting the World Part 1 and edit it straight to Part 2, or I'll take Lifting the World Part 1, that transitions into Three Stories, which then transitions into Lifting the World Part 2. So that's kind of the, those are the main themes there of it. And then once that structure was there and it was almost kind of a bookend of the main parts, then some of the middle movements came together after that. So, for example, Bloodline is a pretty major part of the work, and it's about halfway through And it's the tie between the first half of the album and the second half of the album. So it's almost like Bloodline begins, is like part two, you know?
Right.
So it has, in other words, it has elements and themes from the first half, recapping, and then it has elements and themes foreshadowing the second half.
Now, how did the recording process for that work? Because you're playing multiple instruments on the tracks. How did you do that? Did you have to set the whole thing to a click and then layer all the instrumentation and bring in the other players, or how does that work?
I started every piece myself, so there was a little bit of you know, some setting it to a click, but there's more. It's actually more natural than that for me. But I do start with either, you know, you could kind of tell it either started as a piano track or a drum track. So it, depending on what the main, you know, focus is for the piece, one track I will play through, and that will be the foundation. So when I got to a point where I brought in the choir, when I got to a point where I'm bringing in the orchestral musicians, there's already a very, very strong foundation of instruments there that I performed.
Mm-hmm. And it kind of strikes me that this can't have been inexpensive to record, and it can't be inexpensive to perform this kind of thing live. From a sheer marketplace perspective, how do you make that work and actually get your money back? You know, it's not like you can release a single from this album, for instance, to offset the cost or anything.
Right. You know, back to what I said about kind of letting the chips fall where they may, I'm never really that concerned about money. It always seems to work out. as far as, you know, there are two different things here that I want to talk about. One, as you said, about how I did this in the studio, and then the other is how I perform it live. But the studio, you know, is a way, way different ballgame these days. So I have a studio in my home,
mm-hmm.
and that's how my music starts. So it starts at my home, and then when it gets, there are limitations to home studios, and so when it gets out of my hands, when it's too big for me to continue on my own, then I have to take it to a professional studio and go from there. So, you know, there's not that expense right away other than, you know, the upfront costs of having your own private studio. But, you know, when things are computer-based these days, it is very different than watching a ticking clock at a professional studio and thinking, you know, that you need to rush.
Right.
Most of it was recorded at my home studio. The choir was recorded on location at a chapel at Elmhurst College. Orchestral musicians were either recorded at my studio or the professional studio that I take it to, you know, once it gets to a certain point.
And then taking that into live performance, that's, like you said, that's a whole different ball of wax. How does that work? I guess that's a fascinating thing for me.
You know, my first thought anytime that I perform is, or anytime that I think about performing, is that I need to be able to pull off my work effectively as a solo artist. So that actually really makes my live performance unique. And the way that I thought of this is, you know, when I was composing my first album, was right at, I started to write my first album after I had left a drum group that was very kind of theatrical, dance and taiko type drumming combination. And it was a wonderful group. But there were eight of us, and if one of us couldn't perform, if we didn't have that date free, the concert didn't happen. And so it was heavily relying on, you know, that it took a number of people to make the work happen. And when I wrote my music, and even though I'm layering and creating something that is really big, I didn't want to be limited to that. I wanted to make sure that my first goal was to be able to perform it as a solo artist.
Mm-hmm.
So, that said, I don't set out to note for note recreate the CD. I set out to give the concert attending audience something that they've never seen before. So I will play Lifting the World as a soloist. And I'm not just playing one instrument. I'm playing a number of instruments at the same time. So another thing that I wanted to make sure is that I'm not playing tracks. So I'm creating something live that is in fact live and that is organic in that way, and not just pushing a button on a CD and kind of playing along to that.
Right.
So I've got a piano, drums all around me, I've got bells on my feet, I'm, you know, doing a million different things at one time. So I am creating a sound that seems bigger than one person, even though it's not necessarily exactly, you know, the same arrangement that you're going to hear on the CD. So from there, actually, being able to play it as a soloist has completely opened up a number of doors for me. And now I do have the music fully scored for an orchestra, for band, for percussion ensemble, and choir. So I can do residencies at universities with their musicians, and everybody gets a part, and then we'll work on my music together and perform it at the end of the residency. Or I can be a solo artist and go into a place with, you know, not as much funding or a smaller space, and it's still very effective there. Or I have my, what I call my touring ensemble of about, you know, 6 to 8 people, where I have, you know, I'm doing all that I do, and then I have each instrument that I add adds a very unique element to it. Like I have an electric violin, an electric cello, fretless bass, mic'd amped bassoon, a female voice, and if it gets to the size where, you know, when we're in a theater and all the stars are aligned, I have two percussionists that I add. I add a multimedia show, and sometimes even interpretive dance. So it can be as, I don't want to say small, but it can be me being in a small concert, all the way up to, you know, a big theater show with my ensemble, up to performing with a full orchestra and choir. So mm-hmm. It really can go a number of different ways now that I set it out to be something that I can do myself first.
Pretty neat. Now, how does your experience with Mannheim play into that? I would imagine that the attention that comes to you from that probably helps you book this. Is that correct?
In everything I do, I pour my heart in. So I do get, I do have fans writing to me after the Mannheim shows and going to my website and seeing what else I do. So everything feeds into everything else. So there's definitely, you know, I'm very, very grateful to be in that group. It's a wonderful thing. I just completed my 7th tour with them, and every year it's just a wonderful thing. It's such a tradition for people to go to that for their Christmas season, and it was for me too when I was a kid, listening to those albums when you're putting up the tree, and so now kind of to be on the other side of that, and to be on stage and performing this music that has meant so much to people through their lives is really a very special thing. I don't take it for granted for a second.
Another gig that you've done that was high profile in recent years is Dennis DeYoung.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how that came to you. How did you get the audition?
It was a private audition, and I was actually performing my own work, and some of the guys in the band saw me. And from there, I was probably one of, I think it was maybe 10 to 12 guys that were invited to do a private audition. And that was in the summer of 2007. So it was pretty interesting. I hadn't, you know, I kind of was on a my path here of what I'm doing now. I was on that path. And then when this audition, when this opportunity came up, I kind of thought, you know, I haven't really thought about sticks in a while.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, when I was 10 years old, I loved Paradise Theater, and you know, but that was a long time ago. And so I thought, well, this would definitely, you know, even if I did get this, it would definitely kind of set my course differently. And I felt, you know what, it would be pretty cool to have that. So I went for it, and a series of callbacks later, and we were kind of off and running there.
Now, was that when he reorganized the band to do the Music of Stick show, or was that before that?
That was before. So there were, the Music of Stick show started in about 2010, uh-huh. And there was kind of there were some personnel changes at that point.
Right, and that's the show that sort of reignited his solo career as far as Stick fans really, really, really love that show.
They have a pretty cool DVD package to check out now. Dennis just released it in 2014, and you know, I'm very proud of my work on that DVD. I feel like, you know, within the context of knowing the music and knowing what needed to be, you know, keeping the tradition of that music. I feel like I had a creative element as well, that I feel like I'm on there, you know, that I'm not just playing drums, that my personality is on that DVD. And, you know, I feel very proud, you know, to have a creative stamp on, again, some very timeless music, you know, that people grew up with. So very special in its own way.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really strikes me about the Music of Stick shows, the one that I saw here in Nashville, I was surprised because in the past Dennis has kind of, not in a negative way, but he's adhered really rigidly to certain kinds of arrangements. And it seems like when he revamped the band, he gave a little bit more freedom in creating different parts. It seems like it really opened the music up. Is that a fair assessment, that maybe there was a little bit more freedom after the band's changeover?
If you do something he doesn't like, he'll tell you.
Right.
Again, you have to know the history of the music. I wouldn't have, you know, you can't walk into something like that and just play it your own way. So I think that's why we were all there, is that our ears are to the albums anyways. We know what came before us. It has to come first from you knowing the work. I walked into the first show, everything was completely memorized. You know, I never ever read music on stage. Mm-hmm. In these types of settings, I know that, I have a master's degree in orchestral percussion, so I do read music. But when I am thinking about these touring shows, or my own show, or with Dennis's show, or with Mannheim, I'm always way, 100 plus percent prepared, in the sense that everything that I do is well thought. So I'm not necessarily going, let me see if I can get away with this, you know. everything that I do is well thought out, and I know what I'm doing.
I wanted to ask you how your experiences in Mannheim and with Dennis, how they changed your perspective about music, and did it change anything about the way you are going to approach your own music in the future?
I certainly, you know, I go into every situation as a learning experience. So sometimes you're learning sometimes you're learning what to do, sometimes you're learning what not to do, but there always needs to be some sort of something that you take from it in order to kind of keep your own personal growth. So, you know, I look at something like Mannheim Steamroller and Chip Davis, and I look at these theaters being sold out 35 years later, you know, and I think that guy has done something right here, you know. I look at somebody like Chip Davis as an inspiration because part of what I want to do and part of what my purpose, I feel like my purpose in life is to help younger people to pursue, follow their dreams. I really feel like, you know, I'm 44 years old. I have a wonderful career in music, and really, when you're younger, there's so much of your attention needs to be on you kind of finding your way, and you know, when you get to a point that I am now, I feel like, okay, I'm finally to a point now where I can give back. I can be an inspiration to other people. I can show them, you know, anything is possible, and I can not only tell them that, but I play in a way that they see it. They go, you know, that was amazing, and I am moved by that. I'm inspired by that. So I feel like for my own life that there's very, you know, I'm very, very passionate about giving back. So I want to be a role model, and to have somebody like Chip Davis that you can see has done this, not only has been a success, but has done it the right way, that really, you know, is very passionate about what he does, cares for his musician. I am grateful to have that, you know, have somebody like him as a role model for me, because what I want to do is be a role model to others. So it's nice to have it that way as well, and to see somebody, somebody that has been so successful at doing it the right way.
So recently you announced that your participation with Dennis was coming to an end. Do you want to say anything about that as for what led to that decision?
Actually, it was more, I was very fortunate to be able to do both of those tours for as long as I did. So that luck kind of ran out about, things about the schedules, and it just simply, it's pretty much as basic as I can't be in two places at once, you know.
As much as
I actually seemed like I was in two places at once for almost 8 years, it finally, you know, was sort of a, you know, decision time. And you know, it's too bad to have to give up anything, but decisions had to be made. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, you know, that'll leave some a lot of additional time for you to pursue the lifting the world and trying to bring that to the most attention that you can.
You know, I feel like the timing is really good, because for a few years now, I think Lifting the World was kind of in a state of maybe like 90% to 95% done. And the people in my camp were saying, you know, when are you going to release this album? It is done, release it. And for whatever reason, I felt like, it's not the time to do it. So I, for a couple of years, was just kind of tweaking and, you know, adding little things, reworking just little, you know, things in that 95 to 100% range, you know, of the album being done. And for whatever reason, in 2014, near the end of 2014, before I left for the Mannheim tour, I said, you know what, it's time to put this album out. It was an epiphany that it was time to do that. So coming back after the Mannheim tour, to have this year in front of me with the album done and released is really a blessing, because I now, you know, I can focus on the life of that album and not still having to finish the album, you know. So I think musicians are, you know, artists in general are kind of, they're obviously you're your own worst critic. And I think having the album be done now is freeing, because now the album and that music has a life. So whatever the future holds, it's going to do what it was meant to do, you know, and it's free of me constantly tweaking it and having it live in my studio and having nobody hear it. And, you know, I'm free now to perform the work and to also pursue other opportunities, as far as my own music, maybe some other touring. And, you know, it would just seem like everything kind of came together with Lifting the World at the exact right time. So I'm very big on, you know, everything happens for a reason. You know, I fully have kind of accepted that there's a time to write, there's a time to perform, there's a time to not do any of it, you know, and rest. And, you know, everything, I am a big proponent in you know, allowing life to happen.
I wanted to, I meant to ask you this earlier, what does the phrase Lifting the World mean to you, and why is it the right title for this work?
I think people need something. I think they need something positive. There's a lot of, well, there's a lot of things that can bring you down in the world. And I feel like, you know, like I said before, like, I want this music to speak to you on a personal level. I want you to feel. I don't want it just to be something that is discarded as background or, you know, instrumental music is just something to have on while you're doing something else. I want more. I want more than that. And so I actually, through the years, went back and forth on the title of the album, and was thinking maybe I would just call it Symphony Number 1, or that I would call it just a self-titled album. And I really, the more that I thought about it, it's like, you know, this album is called Lifting the World. I mean, I don't think that I chose that title. You know, I think that title was chosen. You know, I mean, the album is just simply called Lifting the World. I mean, that's what it is. You know, there's no, and as time went on, I just realized that more and more. It's like this album is already named. It's not really up to me.
Is there anything else that you want to say about Lifting the World, or what you've got coming up in the next year or so?
You know, I will be performing it as much as possible. So I'm excited to have this year ahead of me. So I have concerts in Chicago, but I'll be doing some traveling as well. And I'm just a very grateful and I feel like a very blessed guy. So my goal is to share that as much as I can.